Good morning and welcome.
Good morning
and welcome to Who's in the Kitchen. I'm Philothea Beeson and you're listening to WDRT 91.9 FM from Viroqua, Wisconsin, community radio, dirt radio from the ground up. We're coming from the Driftless area, southwestern Wisconsin. And we have a range of about 25 miles, but on the internet we reach all over the world, and we have friends that listen to WDRT from everywhere. This is a wonderful part of our technology and social media, and we've been going for over 11 years. Are we in our 12th year? So I'm beside me is my faithful friend Jim Hallberg, who is my engineer. And this morning we're going to talk to someone who recently came into the area, and when I say recently, it's probably 3 or 4 years ago, but anyway, to take over the Driftless Cafe here in Viroqua, and that's Mary Castman. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you so much, and good morning. Sorry, I kind of jumped the gun on the good morning there.
That's all right. No one ever said good morning back. That's really nice. At least one person is listening. Well, you're welcome to on the show. I have, of course, a lot of us have taken a great interest in the Driftless Cafe as it has evolved. And how old is that restaurant now?
Oh, my goodness.
Say maybe.
I think Luke and Ruthie opened it officially as their own in 2013, I want to say. So, yeah, about 8 years or so.
Okay, so then that goes back to other owners.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
yes.
I don't know the detailed history, but yes,
right.
the Driftless Cafe as a space has been a part of the Viroqua community for quite a long time.
Right, it has. I mean, I think Lars Bergen and some students had the idea of making a cafe. They did a lot of the cleaning and construction of that early space and made it into something they thought would be attractive to young people in the area. And it was manned by volunteers, I think, at first. And now it's grown. It's changed hands several times. And you got it from Luke Zahm.
Well, yes, and Luke and Ruthie are still involved. Obviously, they are still the owners, and Ruthie is the general manager. So she and I work together pretty closely, and Luke is involved with marketing. Obviously, he has lots of other projects, kind of working as Wisconsin's food ambassador, as I like to say, and telling stories of our state and our region, still letting a hand at the cafe and being involved as well. So we've got quite a great little family over there.
Well, that was a nice transition, very nice transition from, and you know, you haven't made a total break, but are still continuing with people who had a history with the place. And yes, I did have Luke Zahm on my show a few weeks ago, and he gave us a history of his life and the cafe, and then getting into Wisconsin Foodie on Wisconsin Public Television, which, as you call, food ambassador. It's really, I have enjoyed his story so much and his involvement with the people that he interviews. He really gets to know people. And
yes, absolutely. I agree. He's a fabulous storyteller, and he's also just deeply engaged with the people he speaks with. You know, I always say he has this charismatic quality of making people feel like they're the only person in the world, because he's just so intent on his listening, and he's very passionate about it, which is infectious, I think.
Yes, it is. And we sort of miss his presence. Does he still do special events through the cafe, or is that your job now?
We've sort of pulled back a little bit from the catering events just because of COVID, and everything made it really difficult. But he does a lot of his own special events related to Wisconsin Foodie and some of the other projects that he's involved with. But special events in general, we're just kind of sort of coming back to after COVID. So we will hopefully be having a lot more in the future. collaborative dinners and you know, inviting other chefs from around the state and around the country to come and like share their stories with us. So yeah, he's definitely very much involved in that planning. I would say that we do a lot of that planning together for anything that's involving the cafe specifically.
Well, Mary, I just want to introduce her as the executive chef at the Driftless Cafe. So she has, you know, the head manager is, you know, Luke and his wife, Ruthie. And then I also talked to your manager because I asked for the manager, and that is Samara. And so,
oh,
that, you know.
One of our lunch managers, yep.
Yes. And I know that it was probably a challenge to take on. You almost came in just at COVID time, didn't you, Mary?
I was the March of 2019. So, you know, kind of, yeah, right before it really, it hit, you know.
Right.
And what we were going full steam, so.
So, what were the ways that you managed to survive during that time of people having to be isolated and not go out? How did your restaurant manage?
Well, you know, I think that we were very, very lucky in that we have a community that supports us through thick and thin. But, you know, that magic word of pivot, you know, everybody sort of had to pivot their business plans. And, you know, we were definitely a part of that as well. So we had to lean on obviously doing more takeout food, which we really only did takeout pieces before. So that was quite a new venture for us in doing that.
Right.
And just leaning towards more like comfort food, things that we could gravitate towards in larger portion sizes, family style dinners, you know, theme nights, you know, certain things like that, so that we could keep people interested, keep people wanting to come back, keep things accessible. But we also kind of used it as an opportunity to get things even more transparent with our suppliers and our farmers to make sure that, you know, we were supporting them as much as we possibly could, you know, in all of this, because that's why we're here, is for the farmers and the growers and the makers of this region, so that we can showcase what they do. So it was very important to us to be able to remain true to that vision, but find a way to make it work so that it was accessible in price and, you know, basically what people wanted in terms of flavor, in terms of comfort food, or whatever it was, you know. So that's really what we ended up doing, and thank goodness the people came out and liked what we were doing. So.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, that does kind of lead into what I would like to talk about, is what is the vision of the Driftless Cafe? Why is it unique? What do you hope people will remember after they've been there? Why do you have a following? I mean, what is so special about it?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that I think that our region is very special to begin with, and it's very unique, and that we have, you know, this concentration of organic small family farmers. I believe it's the second highest concentration in the country by county. I'd have to check with Luke about that, but I'm pretty sure there's a county in California that has us beat. So for such a small area, like population-wise, to have that access to such amazing food, you know, is special. And we are storytellers, whether it's, you know, what we're telling on the plate with the food that we're making, whether it's retelling the story of the farmers that we're working with, you know, having that connection with people when they come in the door, and you know, they want to know why this place is special. We have lots of things to point to, lots of people to talk about. And I think it's very telling that during COVID, you know, we didn't have a lot of the same issues that a lot of the restaurants had with supply chain issues, you know, obviously with paper goods and stuff we did, but in terms of our food supply, like we already were so well connected with our farmers, that we were able to have access to meat when a lot of folks, you know, living in big cities couldn't, or other restaurants that were, you know, purchasing from more broadline suppliers, working directly with the folks in this community. Like, I mean, we just kind of held each other up. So that's why I think it's really special. I think it's the stories. I think it's the land. I think it's this unique sense of place that we have here. You know, I've, you know, lived a couple places in my life, and I can definitely say that Viroqua is home in the sense that, like, I feel a sense of place, a sense of purpose when I'm here. And I think a lot of folks do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, again, it's infectious. It's sort of, we get people in the door, and they come to the Driftless, and they realize what a great place it is, and maybe they want to move out here, and that means we did our job.
It's definitely a place you want to bring your out-of-town family. You got to come to the Driftless.
Yeah,
is it really... It really does seem like a restaurant that's been grown from the grounds up, and it's not a chain, and it's not, it's, you know, it's very human. And when you walk in the door, one of the first things you see is a big blackboard with all the names in chalk of all the the people who supply the restaurant with their you know, produce and their meat and their dairy products.
Yep.
And, you know, there are a few restaurants like that around the United States, but we've got one. You know, we really feel right away there's a connection between the community and the food that goes on your table. And it's seasonal. It's seasonal and it's regional and it's, well, mostly organic, right? Are you are you striving for organic as much as possible?
I mean, we work with a lot of organic farms. We work with a lot of farms that practice organic practices, but, you know, aren't certified. It's definitely not our number one priority. It's definitely an added bonus.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the thing is that we can walk over to the, or drive over, or whatever, walk into in these fields with the farmers and see what they're doing and have that type of transparency, which, you know, not many people can do that. So I, again, feel extremely lucky that we can do that.
Have you worked in more conventional restaurants?
Yes, I have, in the sense of, like, you know, not having quite as much access to, like, local food or such reliance on it, so to speak. But most of the restaurants I have worked at have been pretty committed to sourcing local whenever possible. You know, so I've been pretty lucky in that regard. But in terms of the cafe, like, this is by far the most, concentrated on that I've definitely had in the past. So
right, I was just wondering if you could share with us a little bit of what a more conventional restaurant does in terms of where they get their food.
Well, a lot of more conventional restaurants will work with like a broadline supplier, which, you know, most, I mean, including ourselves, you know, we have to get certain things from a larger company,
like Sysco.
Sysco, Reinhardt, you know, Gordon Food Services, those types of places.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's sort of like when you're living out in a rural area, it's sort of like a necessary evil in a sense, because, you know, we do need access to certain things. But more like chain restaurants, or, you know, there's Olive Gardens or what have you, you know, they're getting stuff that comes in a box and they're heating it up, or they're, you know, or in a bag and heating it up, and it's, you know, it's not what we want to do, that's for sure. But, you know,
so you're definitely cooking things that come in their, you know, pretty natural form, and you are cooking
always
from scratch.
Absolutely.
So the good old home cooking sign. Remember, we used to look for that home cooking.
Yes, for sure. Absolutely.
Well, even the schools, I'm learning, are not even having home cooking much anymore. I was remarking that Monique Hooker, who used to be in our area, has now moved to California, had, you know, done the farm to table and farm to school movement out here. And got so many schools involved and school food preparers back on track, as, you know, find the farmers, get the food,
right,
you know, make it in the summer, freeze it, and pull it out in the winter. You're your own Sysco, your own Reinhardt Foods. You've got it already.
Yep.
But it is very easy for schools to just buy what's on the truck, you know, and... And a lot of that food is, well, just obviously more manufactured, you know, prepared, preserved, and everything. And It takes a lot of time to cook well.
It does, yeah, and it takes labor, you know, which is an issue too right now in the restaurant industry, and I'm sure in the, you know, more industrial side of food preparation. So yeah, absolutely, it's definitely a struggle. I mean, I know that there are people around here that are really trying to change that, and the farmers are trying to work with schools and hospitals and stuff, sort of incorporate more of those local ingredients. But it's very hard, and also right now very expensive, and it's definitely something that we need to get to keep working towards for sure.
Right. Well, one of the things I learned from Sue, I'm trying to remember her name, at Food Enterprise Center, who has really, set up an old building that was going to just kind of go unoccupied and made it into the Food Enterprise Center, where there are many local food preparers that are working there to make food that's locally produced from local ingredients, and then learning how to market that food and supply restaurants and so forth. And one of the organizations in there was the Fifth Season Co-op, which turned out to be a co-op for farmers. And one of the problems of supplying, you know, think, why can't a restaurant or a school just go to a farm and buy stuff? And there's a lot of regulations and a lot of concern that there's safety and, you know, there's inspections and insurance and all that stuff, which by being a part of that co-op protected the farmers. The farmers got inspected and they got a certification so they could sell to schools and restaurants and nursing homes and hospitals, which couldn't happen before that. So there are a lot of infrastructure has been built already here in the Driftless area to make it possible for the food on the farm to get to the table and be recognized that way. And so it's complicated, but it can be done. And there are examples now in the U.S. of how to do this. And Viroqua is one place. You're listening to Who's in the Kitchen on WDRT Community Radio, 91.9 FM, and streaming live on the internet at WDRT.org. We air every Saturday at noon, and we are listening today to Mary Katzen, and she is talking about the Driftless Cafe, and I'm right here in Viroqua, and what was your background, Mary, in cooking? Did you start out loving to cook? Did you find it in college? What did you...
I found it in college. I was a student at University of Wisconsin in Madison as an English literature major, and, you know, my now husband and I, would cook together. And I got a job working in a restaurant close to campus, mostly doing... front of the house management, like the wait staff and the kind of doing some of the bookkeeping and all of that. But I really got interested in the cooking aspect of it, just watching the chefs and, you know, wanting to know more. So I graduated from there in, I want to say, 2007. And then pretty much about a year later decided I wanted to go to culinary school. So I enrolled at Madison College, or what was then Madison Area Technical College. In the two-year culinary program there. I got my associate's degree from there, and then just kind of took off and started working in restaurants while I was in school, and then, moved around a bit, spent some time out in Boston with my husband, who got a job out there, and then we eventually found our way back to our beloved Midwest.
Oh, good. Well, Madison is a wonderful place. It's got lots of restaurants, lots of venues to kind of get to go and see what's going on and practice and work with some really good chefs.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. I was very lucky because one of my teachers or my teaching assistants was the baker at a very wonderful Japanese restaurant in Madison. And so I got my first internship there, And then the chef from there opened up his own place kind of down the street and sort of followed him to that location and continued to learn from both of those folks. And then that kind of landed me a great opportunity once I moved to Boston to be able to work at some pretty outstanding restaurants there. So just very lucky meeting the people that I did, working with the people that I did, opened a lot of doors for me. So,
well, it just, you know, an experience really counts for things. And as you get older, you see how one step led to another and how your life is unfolding. It's really amazing to all of us. And yeah, you might not imagine where you're going to end up, you know, as an adult, what you're going to do and what you really care about. So I'm interested in the kind of cooking that really attracted you. I mean, do you like Asian cooking? Do you like just international cooking or what?
You know, I kind of fell into the Japanese restaurant mostly because of the chefs that worked there. I was just really interested in like sort of the techniques that they were using and the and that sort of, as a young chef, you're really interested in learning how to do things the best way that you possibly can. And you know, Japanese cuisine is so precise and technical that it was kind of a good fit for what I wanted in that moment. But you know, the cuisine that I truly, truly fell in love with was when we moved to Boston. I worked at a restaurant called Oleana, which is a Eastern Mediterranean restaurant, mostly focusing on Turkish food, run by an amazing woman named Anna Sortun, who is still the executive chef there. It was an eye-opener for me because it was a different kind of cooking that was focused on spices and was not heavy. It wasn't like this classical French cooking that you learn in culinary school, but rather this light, vegetable-focused, very, Mediterranean diet style food.
Yes.
And it just, it changed my life, changed my approach to everything. And so I was at Oleana for about 4 years, and then I worked at another restaurant in the same restaurant group called Sarma, which was a small plate restaurant, again, Eastern Mediterranean, but kind of spread the gamut of the Levant and incorporating all those different cultures and countries. So that's what inspires me to get up in the morning and cook. And when I got here and saw all the farms and all of the beautiful vegetables, it's just, you know, it fits in really well with that style of cooking for me. So when I'm at the cafe, which is obviously most days, those are the flavors I'm trying to bring and introduce to people, try to make them a little bit more approachable. Because I know that not everybody has had that experience, but like, you know, really just focusing on how can I make these ingredients shine, you know, using flavors from Eastern Mediterranean. So that's where my passion is.
Well, that's really fascinating, and I'd love to go more into detail on that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So what are the main ingredients that you want to be working with in that kind of, in style of cuisine?
So that's an obvious olive oil, the number one, I would say.
Olive oil, okay.
I had one of my chefs would always say, like, we're in the business of olive oil, chickpeas, and onions. a lot of yogurt, I use a lot of yogurt. I cook with a lot of, obviously, garlic, onions, legumes, you know, so chickpeas, lentils, local beans, like we have these amazing beans coming out from Meadowlark Organic Farms, and, you know, meat to some extent, lamb, local chicken, all of those things. But, I mean, the spice arsenal we could talk about for hours for sure, but I am a cumin, coriander, Aleppo chili type of girl. I don't use black pepper. I use Aleppo or Maras chili, which is a kind of a mild red chili flake. It gives a little bit of heat, but it's not like giving you the bite of like a black pepper. And sumac is something that I use quite a bit, and I'm able to get some locally. People have been kind enough to forage sumac and dry it for me and bring it to the restaurant, is which, that, you know.
Wow. Is that flowers?
It's the pods from the flowers, and you dry them, and then you make a powder out of it, and it's a lemon flavor. Or you sort of use it in the same way you would use citrus or, you know, lemon juice. Sometimes you can make lemonade out of it, actually, if you soak the pods. It's a pretty fascinating plant and very flavorful.
Wow. Do you have to prepare that in advance to have that? I mean, like...
Oh, the sumac?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't have it in supply that's prepared for me all the time. You know, I do source it, but it's actually not too bad if you have a food dehydrator, or just use like a really low and slow oven, you know. It's not too hard of a task.
So I'm really interested in this, because I'm really interested in wild foods, but I mean, are you making it into something that you would make a tisane out of? I mean, you pour boiling water on it to, or how do you extract that flavor?
The flavor is, you can just actually soak the fresh. Now, there is a poisonous sumac, so you don't want to use that one, obviously. They're two different kinds. But you just basically can soak the flowers in cold water, you know, and for like a couple of days, and it'll be like a lemonade. I think the native populations around here used to do that as well. For like a refreshing drink.
So you don't use it as a drink, though? You use it?
No. I use it mostly as a powder, as a spice powder. It's like a crimson berry. Yeah.
Oh.
I'm sure that the co-op probably has it here now. But yeah, it's like a bright crimson berry color.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. That's really cool. And
you think twice when you see sumac growing on the side of the road when you're driving.
Right. So you use olives?
Lots of olive oil, lots of mushrooms, too, local mushrooms. Just really, it's very plant-based, so it kind of fits in really well with with our area. It's just kind of, I'm always struck about like how there's this deep connection between these two cuisines, even though they're geographically in very different places.
Isn't that amazing? It's just like the same concept, though, to look at what grows locally,
right,
and work with that. And of course, that drives you to seasonally, because things are only, you know, I only learned that. I mean, when I was growing up, we ate stuff out of frozen packages. And I didn't even really know what a whole broccoli head looked like when I was growing up. I never really saw gardens. And so I wasn't really familiar with the idea of seasonal until I went to Europe and lived with a Swiss family and wondered why we ate weeks and weeks of dandelion greens, and then that was the end of it, you know. Because, you know, there's times of the year when something is up and out and ready, and the different mushrooms, the morels only come around once a year. You can't go, you know, find them another time. And so local and seasonal really became really important and a new discovery for me, actually. And then I got interested in wild foods, and I continued to be, and it's just a huge, vast amount of information, way more things that we can eat that we didn't know we could eat, as long as you have mentors that know what part of the plant
that's
to eat.
Key.
Yeah. Don't eat poisonous parts of plants.
Right.
You know, it's really wonderful, and we really could sustain ourselves much more on wild foods. And, of course, lots of us are discovering we could eat, you know, our nettle population lamb's quarters and amaranth and things like that are way more prolific than the stuff we're trying to cultivate in the garden, and you know, all that stuff is free. So let's see. Now, do you, as executive chef, you probably Just tell us what kind of jobs you have. I mean, I'm thinking there's a lot of training.
Yes, training of staff. Yes, yes.
That's cooks.
A big part of it. So, I mean, my job is to obviously design the menu, which changes daily.
It does.
Pretty much.
Okay.
Yes. I mean, it doesn't always change from top to bottom daily, but something is always changing on the menu.
Uh-huh.
Based on what is available from our farms that week or that day, or and so, you know, I come in and then I write the menu. I talk to my staff. You know, I really do try to involve my staff as much as possible in the menu design if they have something that they're really interested in trying out, or you know, want to input. I'm always open to that. So we design a menu kind of all together in a sense. And then, you know, assigning tasks, who is going to prep what food, what station everybody is going to work that day. You know, I do the schedule, obviously, for the back of the house staff. I make sure that all the ordering gets done, coordinating the farm orders as well as our broadline orders, our meat orders, everything like that. You know, if I need to go to the Westby Co-op Creamery or Organic Valley, you know, figuring out if I'm going to do that or if my sous chef is going to do that, you know, types of stuff like that are kind of in my purview. But everything comes up every day. It's always a new challenge. So, you know, staffing issues, filling in gaps, you know, training, obviously on certain areas of the menu where we can really, you know, I really want to make sure people try to dial stuff in as much as possible so that we can stay consistent. And, you know, just general morale, hopefully, too, providing that. And,
right.
Yeah, so I wear a lot of different hats, to be sure.
That is, yeah, that's a huge responsibility. I don't know if anybody really knows what's going on behind the scenes. And people can be very critical, you know, if something doesn't turn out right that particular time they went to the restaurant. It's, you know, it's hard, you know, pleasing everybody all the time.
It is definitely hard, and there's always things that are going on behind the scenes, you know, like maybe the dishwasher was sick that day, you know, so someone had to step in, and, you know, restaurants everywhere right now are dealing with staffing crisis, so, like, you know, and being short-staffed, so, but we have the greatest staff in the universe, and my team is incredible, and they come through every day.
Well, it's wonderful if your staff loves where they're working. I think that comes through the food and the service and everything. And, you know, you may have really good techniques, and if the staff is not happy and doesn't get along, you know, it goes into the food. I know Luke always stressed that.
Oh,
he
absolutely.
Said, you know, he worked some places.
Good energy.
Yeah.
Good energy equals good food. Yes.
Yeah.
That's the motto we live by.
That's great. And I was wondering, sometimes the Driftless has actually had its own bakery. I wonder if that's where it is right now. Does it bake its own baked goods?
So we actually have a pretty robust bread program right now. And so we don't have a bakery in the sense of, like, we sell, like, baked items, you know, to go, or like what we do, we're doing a lot of our own in-house bread. If you have come by and had a burger or a fried chicken sandwich at lunch, we are making our own buns for those sandwiches.
Oh, you are?
Chef, yes, yes. My pastry chef, Ryan Rothweiler, is incredible. He is making sourdough bread. He's making ciabatta bread. And then he also does our dessert program for our dinner service. So he's making the desserts. So we usually have a dessert menu about 6 items. We always have the Cowboy David cakes because they're a great friend and ally of the cafe, and so we feature them. But then Ryan does round out that menu with his own desserts. So I would say that it's kind of like a little patisserie shop within the restaurant.
Oh, that's nice. It's nice to know that there is a good baker pâtissier or whatever preparing this. And, you know, if you're doing Middle Eastern food, I'm sure you have do your own flatbread, or do you buy that?
Yes, we do. Well, you know, we do buy some of it. We find a good quality pita that we can use kind of for the, I mean, we sell so much falafel we couldn't keep up with pita production probably, but yeah, we actually our dough that we use for our pizza is very versatile, and we can tweak and change the recipe so that we can make pita for, you know, for dinner service if we're doing something that requires flatbread or something like that. So but yeah, it's wonderful to be able to have such a talented pastry chef who is making some really delicious bread. And that burger bun, though, I tell you, it's so good.
Oh, I have to tell you a little story. I came into the cafe, and some friends of mine were eating there, and they said, "Oh, come sit with us, and be sure to order the burger. It's my meat." You know who I'm talking about. It's my grass-fed beef. What?
There's a couple people I could think who it might have been.
Isn't that cute? You know, because that's really a connection, because the farmers come and eat.
That's the great thing, is that, you know, we can point, the servers can, you know, point to a farmer, you know, like, if, like, there's, like, a melon or something on the plate and somebody asks, they can go, "Well, that farmer over there grew that melon," you know. So, I mean, that's a pretty amazing experience, I think, and
right.
Real true connection.
Well, can you share a few dishes that you prepare that you might give us a little insight about how you make them? Or is it all top secret?
No, it's not top secret.
What are some of your favorites?
Anything in particular? Oh, some of my favorites.
Yeah.
Well, I am really looking forward to tomato season. Obviously, we've started to see some tomatoes kind of creeping in from the greenhouses. Mm-hmm. Fruit has just kind of started to come through. The Amish farmers have come through with some cherry tomatoes. But once we get going with full tomatoes, there's a Turkish dish that is called imam bialdi, which is it basically translates to "the priest fainted." And it's unclear whether or not the priest fainted because it was so delicious, or the cost of all the olive oil that was used to make it. Those are the two versions of the story. But it's basically a stuffed eggplant that you roast. You rub it with, you cut it in half, you rub it with olive oil and salt, roast it till it's tender. You sort of scoop out the center and stuff it with a fresh, I like to call it, it's kind of like a salsa, but it's got a ton of vegetables in it. It's like you basically, one of my favorite techniques that I love to tell people about as like a hack for making salsa is if a box grater, cut your tomatoes in half and then grate them like you would cheese on a box grater.
Uh-huh.
And you get this like tomato pulp that's really fresh, and that use that as your base. And then I just saute a ton of vegetables. So you could be zucchini, you know, fennel, onion, any other type of, you know, seasonal vegetable that you want to throw in there. Those are things I gravitate towards the most. And then use that tomato grate mixture as the base and put all those sauteed vegetables in there, season it with some like oregano, dried mint. That's another spice that I use a lot of, sort of Greek style spices, and then stuff it in that eggplant, and you can eat it warm, you can eat it at room temperature. It's just, I love that dish because for me it's like I get to put so many different farms on one plate, and it's like just coming together of all of these farms on one plate is just like so symbolic for me of like why this place is so special. So I'm really looking forward to that, the eggplant and tomato season, when I can run that dish, because I usually have that on the menu for probably like in some form for like 2 months, because I just love it so much. I like to put fresh corn in there too. It's just a really beautiful way to use, if you have a lot of vegetables in your garden, it's a beautiful way to use them all up, and it's just delicious. So that's one of my favorite things that I like to make.
That sounds good. Do you like cooking with eggplant? Do you do other eggplant dishes?
I do. I love eggplant, actually. I'm technically have like a slight allergy to nightshades, so when I eat it, I kind of pay for it, but I don't care. I still eat it.
What is the best way to prepare eggplant where you get the best flavor? And what are the best kind of eggplants to buy? I kind of find those big fat ones at the grocery store, I find they are kind of bitter.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, actually, I just learned that eggplant has a very specific timing when you have to pick it, and if it goes over that timing is kind of when it'll get bitter. That's kind of an interesting thing for myself if I ever grow eggplants. I haven't in a few years, but I don't usually buy eggplants in the grocery store. I usually, you know, try to just get those from farms or at the farmer's market.
Okay.
Yeah. The black globe eggplant is the most typical eggplant that you're going to see. And I think that if you buy it from a farmer directly, like it's going to be delicious. The Santa Rosa is kind of the more purple, kind of speckly kind. It's often more round and a little bit smaller. It's going to have a little bit of different texture, for sure. I think that it's more a difference of texture than flavor necessarily, but my favorite way to cook eggplant, I have two favorite ways. Roasting just on an open fire or a grill and charring the outside,
mm-hmm.
And letting it just steam cook from the inside, and then, you know, just scooping all that goodness out of there. And whether you're going to make like a baba ganoush, which is like a tahini and eggplant dip, which I love to make, or maybe you're including it in like a roasted vegetable salad, you know, and just putting those lovely smoky eggplant innards or guts in there to add flavor. And then I also just like to slice them into rounds and roast them. They take a ton of olive oil, so, you know, you can never have too much olive oil, and you gotta rub both sides down with olive oil and salt. And roast till they're tender, or grill them as well, you know, and then chop them up again and then add them to your roasted vegetable salad with tomatoes or, yes, I really do love eggplant, but I think I usually make a lot of baba ganoush in the summer for sure. or zalouk, which is a Middle Eastern roasted vegetable salad that has charred eggplant, charred tomatoes and onions and olive oil and all different kinds of spices, squash, that. So,
one of the things I found out about preserving eggplant, I tried lots of different ways, and to me, the best way was to char it in slices.
Yes.
And then I could freeze it, because if you freeze eggplant, it just is a disaster.
I haven't really frozen eggplant before.
It doesn't work.
Yeah, I know.
But, you know, there's a certain amount of you know, moisture that you want to get out of it. I think the grilling is a really good idea.
It tends to like really high heat.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah,
you know.
And you know, just to comment on olive oil, I'm curious about all these things, but sourcing good olive oil, have you got a good place that you get it?
I do, actually. You know, at the restaurant we use a Spanish style olive oil that we get through one of our purveyors, kind of our more specialty food purveyors.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a mild in flavor. Obviously olive oils are going to be, you know, range from, you know, flavor and color and smoking point and all that. So we have like a nice flavored one that's relatively neutral that holds up to heat pretty well. I cook with olive oil like, you know, anybody else would use like a vegetable oil or canola oil. Obviously I don't do deep frying or anything in it, but
So you can cook with olive oil as long as you don't go up past a certain temperature.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, it'll start to get bitter, you know, at a certain point. So it's really like there's nothing that I do in my own cooking where I ever feel like I need to have a heat that's high enough that I would, you know, not be able to use olive oil. Mm-hmm. And if I do have that, then I will use obviously like a sunflower oil or a grapeseed oil or something like that, which, you know, obviously do in the restaurant with more of like our seared meats and stuff, we'll use a more neutral oil. But in terms of anything that I'm cooking, you know, if it's a sauce or if it's a soup or, you know, it's always olive oil for sure. It's a little bit more expensive for sure, but it's so good for you,
and
it's so flavorful, and you know, it's butter is great too, but you know, a little bit of butter, you know, in moderation, and a lot of olive oil.
Right, right. And people are becoming more connoisseurs of butter now.
Oh, yes. And there's so many different kinds of butter, and butter is delicious, and we definitely use a lot of butter, too. So. Mm-hmm. But we have great local butter that we buy by the 40-pound block.
Right. We have some local butter producers that, you know, they have their spring butter, their summer butter, and their fall butter. Because when you start thinking about where butter comes from.
Yeah, the feed of the milk and the cows, it changes the flavor.
Yes, the pastures change and the feed and, yes, and the sunlight. Food is really so, so interesting. And I've had so much fun being on this show as our country, I think our population has gotten more sophisticated about food and more paying more attention where it comes from, how it's raised, and you know what's good for you and what isn't, and being more interested in seasonal and local and what you know how that's really a benefit. So it's wonderful to have a restaurant in our town, and I think we have more than one that's really actually trying to. Now,
yeah, you know. Absolutely. You know, and we are happy to inspire others to do that. You know, that's, you know, one of the things that I always like to talk about is, you know, how can we be more than just a restaurant, you know? And I think that, you know, we have a space and in our community where we can really be a place that, you know, is a place for social change and, you know, setting the conversation around local food and, you know, our farmers and a healthy workplace, you know.
So, right, just a different model. I think in some ways the food industry has been suffering partly because it has a model of paying staff as little as possible, I think.
Well, yeah,
and
for
you know,
sure.
It's hard to make a living, you know, yes, buying quality food and also having a nice physical place to eat in, and you know, you're keeping up your kitchen equipment and so forth, but then having a really good staff that's competent and qualified in the back of the house and in with the customers.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think that COVID is, you know, if even through all of its negatives, it has definitely brought that conversation to the forefront, you know. And, you know, I think that people might have to start thinking about, you know, paying more money for their food when they dine out, you know, that there are a lot of costs associated with that, not just the food itself. And, you know, I mean, in Europe, this is not a new phenomenon. So yeah, I just encourage people to think about everything that's going into that plate, you know, and you know, that you're paying for the experience as much as you're paying the food, and you know, you're supporting our community by coming out, and we are able to have a wonderful staff and cultivate a culture that we are really proud of, and you know, we love being here. We love being a part of the Viroqua family.
That's really wonderful, and I just want to thank you so much, Mary, for being on Who's in the Kitchen. I've been talking with Mary Castman. She is the executive chef, that sounds so important, of the Driftless Cafe right here in Viroqua, Wisconsin. It was one of the first, really, to get into the farm-to-table model where, you know, the menu changes as the year goes around. The names of the suppliers of the food are up on the blackboard, and that, you know, individual people are creating recipes and creating the menu that, you know, evolves and changes with the people. Such a different model from a chain restaurant, which has its place because people know exactly what they're ordering. They can recognize, you know, the menu in every single place they go to. And some people like to eat that way where it's very predictable. Fortunately, here in Viroqua, we are developing some family-style restaurants in the sense that each chef and crew is really producing something from our community and something very unique and not at all part of the chain restaurant picture. And I think, I've heard, and I agree, that the more restaurants you have in an area, the more people will come there. And, you know, it's not like the restaurants are even in competition. It just makes a richer experience for people. And it's really a joy to have three or four places to choose from here in this little town of 4,000.
Absolutely.
So, thank you again, Mary. And
oh, my pleasure.
We've been talking about the Driftless Cafe here in Viroqua. And I'm Philothea Beeson. I do this show every week, airing at noon on Saturdays. So I hope when you're on your way to the dump or coming home from the farmer's market, you'll tune in and listen and hear about local people cooking, not just restaurants, but people who like to bake and barbecue and search for wild foods and make teas and just all kinds of different things. And you can go on our website, which is WDRT.org, and go to locally produced shows, I believe is how it's organized. And then you find who's in the kitchen. But we have quite a few podcasts now that you can listen to of past shows. So if you've enjoyed hearing this show or you want to share it with other people, it will be on the archives by Monday. You'll be able to listen to that and other past shows from Who's in the Kitchen. So thank you to my audience. I know a lot of who you are, but I don't always know how many people are listening. But anyway, I'm so glad that you tune in and support WDRT Community Radio. And I'll see you next week.